the rush to California and the attitude not merely of merchants, but of philosophers and prophets, so-called, in relation to it, reflect the greatest disgrace on mankind, that so many are ready to live by luck and so get the means of commanding the labor of others less lucky without contributing any value to society. And that is called enterprise? I know of no more startling development of the immorality of trade and all the common modes of getting a living. The philosophy and poetry and religion of such a mankind are not worth the dust of a puffball. The hog that gets his living by rooting, stirring up the soil so, would be ashamed of such company. If I could command the wealth of all the worlds by lifting my finger, I would not pay such a price for it. What a comment! What a satire on our institutions! The conclusion will be that mankind will hang itself upon a tree. Henry David Thoreau's comments about the California gold rush in Life Without Principle. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Most of us picture the gold rush as white males out west in the middle of the 1800s trying to get rich quickly by panning for gold and taking breaks by visiting the saloons or shooting each other. Why is it that we don't think of the Chinese, Mexican, South American, French, and Native American miners also panning for gold? With so many more men than women, who did so-called women's work in the mining camps? Joining us to discuss the fascinating and surprisingly complex world of the California Gold Rush is Susan Lee Johnson, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the author of Roaring Camp, The Social World of the California Gold Rush.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I think we've tapped a rich vein of history here.
It's hard not to use those metaphors.
It's easy to think of California in those years before the Gold Rush, pre-Sutter's Mill in 1848, as almost idyllic compared to what came later. Was it that way? Was it a time of relative tranquility under Spanish rule?
Well, it was certainly a calmer time. There were fewer people. I would say certainly for California Indians, it was not an idyllic time at all. The Spanish came to California relatively late in their colonial project. They'd already been in other parts of what we now think of as the Southwest. They didn't come to California till 1769 and established a set of missions and presidios and pueblos there. But this really wreaked havoc on the native populations, so that in the coastal areas where the Spanish settled, the native population dropped precipitously over the next few decades. So that by the time of the gold rush, native peoples had really lost any autonomy in the coastal areas. It was different up in the interior of California, in the Central Valley, in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada, and in the mountains themselves. In that area, native peoples really were still very much in control of their geography of residence and, in fact, sometimes wreaked havoc themselves on Spanish settlements by raiding horses, etc. So it was a very contested world before the time of the gold rush, but certainly there were fewer people, fewer kinds of people before the discovery of gold in 1848.
What tribes are we talking about?
Well, in the area that became the gold country, we're talking about Miwoks, Nishinans, Maidus, a number of different tribal groups, people who lived in communities of, say, 100 to 300 people, usually in the drainage of a river in the area. But most of these peoples had not been drawn into the Spanish missions and were living relatively independent of that colonial project.
You seem in your book to be interested in contrasting the kind of tales we tell about the gold rush or the two-sentence gloss that you might find in a textbook with the more complex picture. And I was struck by the epigraph that you use for your opening. I guess it's a preface. I believe it was a Belgian miner. I was wondering if you could read that and talk about why you open your book about the California gold rush with that.
Sure. Yes, this is a Belgian gold seeker, a man named Jean-Nicolas Perlot. And he was writing in his reminiscences, remembering back to this time. and thinking about working alongside Indians in the mines. And he said this, "Until about the 20th of September, the Indians had worked constantly around us. All the companies let them go freely where it seemed good to them, even in our ditches, to gather the pay dirt in their pans, carry it on their heads, and go wash it at the river. The women especially did this work. However, I have never seen an Indian woman cede to her husband the gold she gathered, which made me suppose that each one worked for herself." And I think I chose that epigraph to start out the book because it's a picture with which we're completely unfamiliar. We don't really think even about Belgian men being involved in the gold rush, say nothing of Native people actually engaging in gathering gold. And of course, in this case, not in all cases, but in this case, it was women who were doing that work. And that seemed to have been fairly common during the California gold rush, where women seemed to have assimilated the process of getting gold to their own gathering practices, gathering nuts and fruits and seeds, etc. So it's that striking unfamiliarity that I want to kind of constantly bring before people.
And the reason I'm going to guess here that we haven't heard, most of us, of these particular tribes of Indians is that they're fairly small groups and that we didn't have these long conflicts between those tribes and the whites that we did with some of the larger tribes.
Well, I'm not sure it's so much that they're smaller tribes, and they actually didn't live in what we would now think about as tribes. They lived in small interrelated bands who shared a language, but lived, you know, relatively independent of one another. I think the reason we don't know as much about California Indians has to do with the catastrophic demographic decline of Indian peoples in California. There were maybe about 300,000 Native people in California at the time when the Spanish arrived. And by the end of the 19th century, there were about 30,000 Native people left. Now, some of that decline came with the California mission system and during the Spanish and then in the Mexican period, but much of it came at the time of the gold rush. And it came about both through direct violence, wars, military conflicts, but also it came about as a result of diseases to which Native people simply had no immunity.
Did the Spanish use Indians as slaves, or were they mostly interested in converts?
Yes, I guess is my answer. I mean, I think the Spanish goal with Native peoples was not to eliminate them, but to incorporate them into the Spanish Empire, not on equal terms with other Spanish citizens, but as converts, as workers. You know, they did a large amount of the building of the missions, the upkeep of the missions. So it's a both and, not an either or.
Fairly extensive mission system then by the time we get to the 1840s?
Yes. Actually, the missions by that time had been secularized, meaning the lands were taken away from the church. This is all as a result of Mexican independence from Spain in 1821. But up until that point, there had been 21 missions established along the coast of California from San Diego to north of what is now San Francisco, and had drawn in the large part of the coastal population and immediate inland population of Indian people. In the 1830s, the Mexican government was worried about the power of the institutionalized church, and so the process of secularizing the missions was one that took place at that time. And those mission lands ended up, of course, not in the hands of the Indian people who had helped to create and build and sustain them, but rather Californios or Californians of Mexican descent.
John Sutter, though, was actually what, Swiss?
Yes, he was Swiss. After 1821, when Mexico won its independence from Spain, the new Mexican government worried about the security of their settlements in California. And they simply couldn't draw enough Mexican settlers up into California. So they started to welcome non-Mexicans who would pledge to become Mexican citizens and offer them land grants, especially in outlying areas, as they did John Sutter. shutter in the area of what is now Sacramento, to act as kind of buffers against Americans who were starting to pour into the area from the east. Russians had designs on California. England did. So the idea was to create new Mexican citizens that would help secure California for Mexico. It did not have that effect, however.
Sort of what they tried in Texas, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. It was kind of like, inviting the fox into the hen house.
Right.
But we know that in historical hindsight, it didn't necessarily appear that things would turn out that way at the time.
You focus on the southern mines in your book and say that they have received less attention than the northern area. Why is that?
Yes, the southern mines, when I first talk to people about this, they often think I'm talking about Southern California. The southern mines are not in Southern California. They're in Central California. But the way they're distinguished from the northern mines are in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada along the tributaries of the Sacramento River. The southern mines were in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada along the tributaries of the San Joaquin River. So sort of from San Francisco, you'd go due east and a little bit south, and you'd be into the area called the southern mines. The southern mines was, that area was much more diverse in terms of race, ethnicity, nationality of the participants. It drew the largest number of Spanish-speaking miners who came from Mexico, well, first from Spanish-Mexican California, then especially from the Mexican state of Sonora. Chileans came in great numbers, and smaller numbers of Peruvians and other South Americans. The southern mines also seemed to draw a disproportionate number of European miners, especially French miners and other French-speaking miners like the Belgian fellow that I just mentioned. Starting in, about 1852, Chinese started to pour into the mines. They didn't come to the southern mines in greater numbers than the northern mines, but they became a very significant population in the southern mines. And this, of course, in addition to all the Anglo-Americans, African-Americans, both enslaved and free, and this entire immigrant population then was plopped down in the midst of a native population that had been, up until this time, pretty much in control of this area.
And how fast did things move once the gold had been discovered in one place in 1848?
And how did that really come about? Was it, in fact, John Sutter or one of his men kicking in a creek or something and turns up a shiny nugget?
Yes, John Sutter had decided to build a sawmill a little bit away from Sacramento, up towards the foothills in what is now Coloma, California. And one of his workers, who actually was an overseer of native workers, native and some Hawaiian workers who were working on this sawmill, building it. But yes, it was James Marshall, who worked for John Sutter, who first saw that nugget of gold in the American River and spread the word from there. But we tend to forget that he was not just a lone white guy out there building a sawmill. Mm-hmm. He was also an overseer of native workers.
So it would have been impossible to keep it quiet.
Why would, from the point of view of someone working on a project like this? I mean, actually, there was some attempt to keep it somewhat quiet. Maybe Sutter and his people could keep the gold to themselves, but that didn't last too long.
And the people who went to mine the gold, to pan for gold, I have always wondered how many hours of panning did it take to come up with a nugget generally? You sort of picture people hours and hours and hours with nothing.
Well, it really varied. But in that first 1848, 1849, those surface diggings were completely untapped. I mean, certainly native people had seen the metal, shining in the rivers and in the dirt, but gold simply had no meaning, no economic meaning the way it did to non-native societies. So those early years, the gold was relatively easy to get with a pan, a pick, a shovel, a spade, either in the dirt and especially in stream beds or river beds. So it was relatively easy. And say in 1848, the average yield for a miner was about $20 a day. That's an extraordinary wage for 1848. It declined from there down to maybe $16 in 1849 and continued to decline over the 1850s till by the time you get to the end of the 1850s. the average miner might take in, $3 a day. But still, considering wages for experienced miners in the East were, say, lead or coal miners were about $1 a day, this was still good money. Of course, the prices of goods and provisions were also quite high, so it wasn't quite as extraordinary as it might at first sound. But those early years, months and, say, the first year or two of the gold rush before so many people came and just kind of swarmed over the foothills, it wasn't that hard to get gold, but you had to get there very early.
Yeah. And why was Thoreau so angry about it, for example, calling it this great disgrace and that, you know, a hog rooting the ground was better off than somebody mining for gold? If it was hard labor and you ended up with a wage, what was so bad about it from his point of view?
Well, I think what was so bad about it is that those initial months or a year or so were over very quickly. And after that, your success really depended as much on luck as it did on hard work. And you could have two groups of miners working side by side, and one could easily make that $16 a day in 1849, and the next party could find nothing at all.
Unless they were better at claim jumping.
Right. Exactly. And there was certainly a lot of that. But I also think this happened at a moment in sort of the development of capitalism in the United States and really worldwide as the economy was shifting from a kind of commercial capitalism to an industrial capitalism, and ideas about work and money were also in flux. And the idea was that if you worked hard, you would succeed. And the gold rush seemed to throw that into question. Not necessarily if you worked hard were you going to make it rich. And maybe you wouldn't work very hard at all and strike it rich. And
luck.
Of course, luck. I mean, the truth is that most people did not succeed. Most people came to California, invested a fair amount of cash just to get there, and went back pretty much in the same situation that they arrived in.
What was the price of gold in 1849, and was it affected by the sudden rush of the metal?
Well, an ounce of gold was worth about $16 at the time. I'm not an economic historian, so I can't kind of recite off all those facts and figures. But what I do know is that the supply of gold in the U.S. and the world economy just increased exponentially and lifted, for example, the economy of England, which was in very, very dire straits at the time, really lifted them out of a very difficult situation. So even though individual miners generally failed more often than they succeeded, the influx of gold into the world economy was really extraordinary.
Just because there was more buying power in America in particular, so they could buy English goods that ordinarily would have sat.
Right, right, exactly. And also, British investors were very interested in the California gold rush, and particularly as miners started to turn their attention away from these surface diggings, the placer diggings, and turning their attention more to the quartz gold or vein gold, the gold that was really buried in the earth that had to be taken out of hard rock. Now, when the quartz mining boom started in the early to mid-1850s, that's when British investors took a great interest in California gold. Unfortunately, quartz mining techniques were not very well developed at the time, and they often lost their shirts, but a few did make their fortunes, as did some American capitalists as well.
We're going to take a look at the domestic life of the miners when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
We want to know what you think. Get in touch with us at WPR.org and click on Listener Feedback. Your comments are important to us. That's WPR.org.
He began with blowing up Garrison, the colored man, for not coming to lend him a hand, and then commenced throwing out his hints to me that I had a fine tent and that the sick man was a-layin' on wet blankets and on the wet ground. It is damned hard if people that are in parties together and have sick men amongst them that they should be unwilling to take care of them. I said to him that the party the sick man belonged to should be made to take care of him, or they should be drove from the mines. A comment by a miner in the California Gold Rush. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Susan Lee Johnson, and we're talking about the California Gold Rush. You mentioned in your book that this is a time in history where you have a lot of men in one place in terms of the ratio of men to women, and that there's a lot of arguing over who's going to do the women's work in the camp. And I assume taking care of someone who's sick would fall in that category.
Yes, it would. And in this particular situation, a fellow named William Miller was living and working alongside a group of black miners. And in a neighboring camp, there was an ill miner, an Irish fellow, I believe. And the neighbors asked William Miller to take this fellow in, to take care of him, which they refused to do. They didn't feel they had the resources to do that. But these neighboring white miners thought it was outrageous that they would live alongside and work alongside black miners but wouldn't take in a white miner. So in this case, the dispute is perhaps more about race than it is about gender. But these kinds of disputes over caring for minors, over cooking, over sewing, really help to expose the complicated nature of both gender and race relations during the California Gold Rush.
What was a typical mine like before we get into the quartz mining, which is obviously more industrial in its need for mechanization, that kind of thing? How many miners typically in one of these, and who did what?
Well, men worked in really quite small groups. Often maybe 2 to 5 men would live in a tent or a cabin together and work a small plot of ground. Now, sometimes several groups, you know, cabins full of miners would join together to take on a more complicated task, say that they thought gold was lining a riverbed and they wanted to divert the stream to get at that gold. That took more men. But this isn't a situation where you have large capitalists owning mines and wage workers working for them. That would come in time, but at this time it was largely these small groups of men working cooperatively with one another.
Mark Twain has a story actually set in the war where the men are arguing over who has to cook and who has to do the grunt work and trying to create a hierarchy. Uh-huh. How did that generally proceed if you had a group of, let's say, 5 men and then it's time to come home and eat and somebody's got to wash the clothes and so on?
Well, in general, it seems that the most common pattern, I mean, it's hard to say, but from reading men's journals and letters and diaries and their observations of other groups of men seem to have hit upon a scheme where each man in a cabin or tent would have a cook week, and that week he would be responsible for procuring all the necessary provisions and cooking up the staples, the beans, the bread, what have you, and serving the men. And the next week it would be someone else's responsibility. There were many variations on that theme, and sometimes there would be situations where, you know, 2 men would be mining together and one would be a better cook than the other, and so they might make some sort of deal. I'll do all the cooking if you spend some more time digging in that hole. But in general, it was a fairly cooperative situation. On the other hand, in the towns, this is sort of out in the camps where men lived in small groups. In the towns, increasingly domestic labor over time became the province of non-Anglo-American men. So one would find African-American or Chinese men running laundries, for example, or French men who were considered by Anglo-Americans particularly adept at cooking would work in restaurants or run restaurants. And this didn't come about because Chinese men were especially enamored with doing laundry or French men wanted to cook for all the rest of the Gold Rush participants, but because Anglo-Americans increasingly tried to push non-Anglo-Americans out of the mines. So it was a way of kind of finding a niche and being able to mine the miners, so to say.
How were all of the goods delivered? You don't have any railroad to speak of out there. I mean, there's certainly nothing transcontinental yet.
No railroad whatsoever. I mean, most of the goods came overland. I mean, certainly goods were shipped to San Francisco from, you know, from the East Coast, from South America, from China, from Hawaii. And then goods came, you know, up the Sacramento River, down the San Joaquin River, and then overland up into the mines.
Well, that's one reason it was so expensive,
right.
Other than price gouging.
Right, exactly. So
a lot of towns spring up then fairly quickly as almost like distribution centers?
Absolutely. San Francisco was obviously the most important of these, but Sacramento was the sort of the supply center for the northern mines. Stockton was the supply center for the southern mines. And then smaller kind of gradations of towns sprang up all through the mines.
And what about the sort of banditry? You know, you open your book actually with a chapter that has to do with a particular family and bandits and so on. But I would think if you have people looking for gold, even if they start out in groups, if somebody finds that piece of gold, you've got to rely on the fact that they're going to share it.
That's right. And I think, again, in those early months, year or two of the gold rush, there was sufficient gold that at least the way miners write about this in their letters and diaries and reminiscences, there wasn't as much conflict over gold. There wasn't as much claim jumping or stealing. But as more and more people poured into the Sierra Nevada foothills and as, you know, the daily yield of miners declined, you see much more conflict over gold. You see much more theft, claim jumping, what have you. And some of that took the form of what we might call banditry. As you said, I opened the book with the story of Joaquin Murrieta, who's a legendary figure who has some basis in history. I don't think we'll ever get back to the actual historical Joaquin, but there is some basis, in fact, to his story. But he was probably a Sonoran miner who came to California with his family, including his wife, and immediately met with the opposition of Anglo-American miners, and the family experienced a series of outrages at the hands of Anglos, which seems to have turned Joaquin Murrieta and his male relatives away from mining towards horse raiding. They would steal horses and drive them down to Mexico, towards gambling, all sorts of things. And eventually, according to Anglos, he started to steal and rob from Anglo camps. Now, the problem with this story, as Anglos constructed it, is that they seemed to see this Joaquin Murrieta everywhere in the mines. He could be in several different places at once. And in fact, when the stories first started to be circulated, the name Joaquin wasn't even necessarily attached to this banditry. Over time, someone named Joaquin became a kind of central figure. But very late in these stories does anyone named Joaquin Murrieta actually appear. And by that time, the state of California had sponsored a band of rangers who went out after this elusive Joaquin and his associates. And they did track someone down. I doubt it was this person, Joaquin Murrieta, tracked him and his compatriots down, killed him and one other man, cut off their heads, cut off the hand of one of his compatriots who had only three fingers, so cut off this three-fingered hand, and then displayed these items all around California. Apparently, they were displayed all the way up until the great San Francisco earthquake in the early 20th century, and then they disappeared. But I use this story in a couple of different ways. But most importantly, all of these events took place in about 1853, about midway through this decade-long California gold rush from 1848 to 1858. And I use this incidence of banditry to show the ways in which Mexican and other non-Anglo-American miners tried to create a place for themselves in the gold rush after they had been pushed out and handled very roughly by Anglo-Americans in the early years.
Whose land was it in the first place? When we talk about, you know, going out and staking your claim and all that, but who owned this land?
Well, ownership is it's an odd concept. I mean, this land was Indian country. This was land that Spanish Mexicans and others feared entering into before the time of the California Gold Rush. Indian concepts of ownership were vastly different than Anglo-American concepts of ownership or Spanish Mexican concepts of ownership. But by 1848, California, which had been part of the Spanish Empire, then part of the new nation of Mexico, by 1848, that land had passed into American hands at the end of the U.S.-Mexican War. So according to the U.S. government, this was public land. This was federal land. You know, Native people certainly didn't see it that way. But even though the federal government claimed this land, they had no control over it whatsoever. There was no government. There were no courts. There was nothing there. All of that came about as a result of the gold rush.
So how do you stake a claim then? I mean, by whose authority? Just by the gun or what?
Yeah, by the gun. Now, eventually, as more and more people poured into the area, miners would band together and create what they called mining district laws, where they would say you can, you know, stake a claim of this amount of land and you have to, you know, leave a shovel there or, you know, some evidence that you are working there. And often those mining district laws also included provisions that prevented, say, Mexicans or Chileans or later Chinese from working in those areas. And that was a kind of informal system that eventually became kind of codified into law. But at first it was very ad hoc and kind of on-the-ground way of controlling a really chaotic situation.
And maybe that's one reason this whole period of time has such an appeal on people's imagination is it's kind of an outlaw culture. Can you say something about the chapter title that you have in your section on the boom called Bulls, Bears, and Dancing Boys?
Yes, that chapter is really about the practice of leisure during the California Gold Rush. The bulls and bears refer to a Mexican practice of staging bull and bear fights where you'd put a bull and a bear in a ring and let them work it out between themselves. The dancing boys refers to the practice of dancing in the Gold Rush, and particularly especially not so much in the larger towns in the southern mines, but in the smaller camps. These were dances that were largely all male affairs. In the towns, one would have dance halls where French or Mexican, Chilean women, where men might pay to dance with women. But out in the camps, these were largely all male affairs. So that chapter really deals with these practices of leisure and how all these questions about race and gender that were so explosive during the Gold Rush were kind of worked out across the terrain of leisure.
What surprised you most as you were looking into this and the gender roles and the racial relations?
I think both in this chapter and in an earlier chapter where I talk about domestic life in the diggings, what drew me to this, my training really was in women's history. And as I approached these communities, and in the 1850s, these were communities that were upwards of 90% male, except for in the larger towns. So I was very curious about how men handled gender in these kinds of situations. How did they work things out? Where, this is the 19th century where there are, you know, pretty distinct sets of tasks that men and women engage in. And suddenly these men and men from all over the world are thrown together and have to figure out how to live with one another. I think I was surprised at the way men worked out domestic situations so cooperatively. They don't seem to have taken those practices back home and shared domestic work with their wives and sisters and mothers. And in the terrain of leisure, I think, you know, maybe what surprised me the most, given what I knew about the discrimination and violence against non-Anglo-American miners, was the very frequent and intense interaction among different groups of miners. So in the dance halls, even in the churches, and just in the everyday practices, how much people rubbed up against one another, and not only in problematic and violent ways.
Did the gold rush speed up California statehood? I mean, here we've only acquired California in 1848. Just 2 years later, it's a state.
Absolutely. And there was a set process by which new territories were supposed to become states. And this was set up in the Northwest Ordinance at the end of the 18th century. California skipped all of that. They just kind of leaped to statehood just because the population increased so drastically from maybe the non-native population was about, 13,000 at the time of the gold rush. And it just, tens of thousands of people poured in a matter of 2 or 3 years. So California petitioned for statehood in 1849 and achieved statehood in 1850. So, California would have become a state one way or the other, but I don't think it would have been the same sort of state without the California Gold Rush.
How long did it take for the surface mining to play out and for the quartz kings to move in?
Well, it actually took a very long time, and I would say that even though quartz mining started in the early 1850s, still by far the largest amount of gold was coming out of the surface diggings, and that continued through the 1850s. So people imagined that there would be this huge boom in underground mining, in quartz mining, but as I mentioned earlier, the techniques really weren't that well developed. It really wouldn't be until the time of the Comstock lode, the great silver boom in Nevada that happened in the next decade, that underground mining techniques would be very well established, very effective, and people would really start to make their fortunes in quartz mining.
How much did it affect the interior of the country? I mean, we know we had, wagon trains coming across before this in the 1840s. But did it really accelerate the settlement in between the Mississippi and the Rockies?
Well, it did partly. Before the California Gold Rush, the overland migration, folks who were coming from the eastern United States were headed overwhelmingly to Oregon. That was their destination. A few were kind of trickling into California. But the moment gold was discovered, that was flip-flopped, and many fewer people were headed to Oregon, many more to California. But what really happened, I think, is that the discovery of gold in California and the wealth that was created made people look to more gold rushes. So in the Comstock lode in Nevada, there was a gold rush in British Columbia, and mining strikes in Montana, Arizona, Colorado. I actually should have said earlier, because that was one of the very early rushes. So people from California who mined in California fanned out into all of these other areas, and then, of course, more people started to flood across the plains. So California prompted this interest in mineral wealth, and people fanned out all over the West, and eventually the country in between filled in, I guess one could say.
And would you say the newspapers are playing a key role in spreading any sort of rush?
Oh, yes. It took a while for the news of the California Gold Rush to make it back to the United States. The mails were notoriously slow, so the first people to respond to the rush were, Mexican Californians, people in northern Mexico and Sonora, Hawaiians, people who were up in Oregon who had immigrated there. But once the news reached the East Coast and was sort of confirmed by the federal government, then the newspapers just went wild. So it was the newspapers, but also word of mouth and letters that were going back and forth. But the newspapers were very important and not always terribly accurate, but certainly created a great deal of excitement.
Well, when there's a boom, there's a bust, and we're going to look at the decline from this California Gold Rush when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Wisconsin Public Radio offers you lots of programs on two networks. If you have questions about them, our audience services staff is ready to help. Call 1-800-747-7444 for information.
After I left, they began to live in a more civilized way. Got married, settled down, raised families, instead of keeping themselves in hot water, striving to make a pile and leave. They settled down and lived like white folks. John Robertson, a California miner of the 1850s, looking back 50 years at the way it was and the way things changed, probably pretty quickly. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Susan Lee Johnson, author of Roaring Camp, The Social World of the California Gold Rush. Things that we've already seen happened quickly in California at the end of the 1840s and into the 1850s and changed quickly in terms of boom. And how quickly did the bust come?
Well, the bust came very quickly, too. Processes that might take, you know, decades in some other part of the West, in California and the gold country, were just telescoped into 10 short years. And in the early 1850s, there were a series of wars, one could call them disputes, between Anglo-American miners and other miners, Anglos and Chileans. There was a foreign miners tax imposed on foreign miners that drove many Spanish and French-speaking miners out of the mines. And there was a war called the Mariposa War between Anglo-Americans and Miwok Indians in the mines. And as a result of these conflicts, by the mid-1850s, one could say that Anglo-American dominance in the southern mines in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada, that dominance was beginning to be much more firm. And the miner that you quoted actually left the mines sometime in the 1850s, but he's been writing back and forth with someone who stayed in the mines, and he's reflecting there on what his friend is telling him about how things change, that miners settled down, they got married, they raised families, and they lived like white folks, John Robertson says. And I think what he is talking about is this process of the imposition of Anglo dominance and then how that played out over time. And that imposition has several parts to it. One of the most important things that happened in, say, the early to mid-1850s is that Anglo-American women started coming into the mines, joining their husbands and fathers and brothers, and they were quite appalled by the social conditions they saw, and they often banded together to protest brothels, dance halls, gambling saloons, which may sound all well and good, but some of these enterprises, brothels, dance halls, gambling saloons, were precisely the places that, say, Mexican or Chilean and French women were making a living. So this imposition of Anglo dominance was not simply white miners taxing or excluding miners from other places in the world. It also had this gender dimension where white women came in and were kind of appalled by what they were seeing and worked to exclude women we'd now call women of color.
So the Anglo-social values are being imposed.
Right, right. That was never complete. That dominance was never complete. It was always contested. And one of the most other important things that happened in this period is that starting in about 1852, Chinese miners and a much smaller number of Chinese women started to pour into the mines. So even as Mexican and Chilean and some French-speaking miners left the mines because they didn't want to deal with the foreign miners tax or they were tired of being pushed off their claims, Chinese miners started to move into this area.
Can you say something about the discrimination they faced? Because it seems as if they were regarded differently than, say, the French or the Belgian and so on.
Well, I think Chinese miners came in at a time when the average daily yield of a miner was declining pretty precipitously. And in fact, Chinese miners seem to have been quite successful. So Anglo miners worried about that, but they had seen what happened when the foreign miners tax was imposed in 1850. It drove so many Spanish-speaking miners out of the mines that commerce virtually collapsed in the southern mines. In 1852, the state of California imposed a new foreign miners' tax, really that was directed at the Chinese miners. But having learned a lesson from that earlier foreign miners' tax, they imposed it at a much lower rate so that Chinese miners, they would try to evade the tax, but if they couldn't evade it, they simply paid it as a way of being allowed to stay in the mines. And Chinese miners really did quite well. There was discrimination isn't really even the word. There would sometimes be disputes within Chinese communities that would erupt into kind of paramilitary conflict. Anglo-American miners would hear about this and come and kind of surround the conflict and watch it as if they were watching a football game.
Bear versus bull.
Right.
Well, and you've got crime pamphlets in your book, and sometimes the illustrations that were used to show Chinese assassins or something, they definitely were portrayed as sort of diabolical looking.
Right, exactly. And you see that, you can also see that in you know, political cartoons from this era. I mean, the great era of, say, the Chinese Exclusion Act that the federal government passed in 1882, that was still very much in the future, but you see the beginnings of those sort of attitudes and exclusionary practices starting here in the California Gold Rush. So you've got people leaving the mines. At the same time, you have an influx of Anglo-American women and of Chinese miners, a small number of Chinese women, most of whom, it seems, were enslaved or indentured prostitutes. And some of these women worked in places like San Francisco or Sacramento or San Joaquin, but some came into the southern mines as well.
You take your title, Roaring Camp, of your book from a Bret Harte story. Yet you talk about at the end of your book that the Bret Harte story sort of doesn't quite get it right.
Well, Bret Harte probably more than any other single American writer helped to kind of codify memory of the Gold Rush in the United States. Now, he did not ignore the racial and ethnic diversity, the kind of conflicts that arose in the mines, but he tended to make of that diversity a kind of colorful background for the adventures of Anglo-American miners. The title Roaring Camp comes from the title of a Bret Harte short story. He was a great short story writer, The Luck of Roaring Camp, which is a story about the fate of a mixed-race child, a baby who's born to a Cherokee woman, the father is unclear, who becomes the luck of Roaring Camp. And I won't recount the whole story here. But part of the reason I choose that title is to take on that kind of collective memory of the California Gold Rush that people like Harte helped to codify and expose a much more complicated history.
One thing I have to tell you is last night when I was reading your book about the Gold Rush and so on, I then checked my email and found an offer in my spam file for a gold mining partnership, you know, great opportunity that could await me. And so the quote, "The internet is like a gold rush. The only people making money are those who sell the pans." I'm curious if you can apply the lessons of the California Gold Rush to things today, and whether, in fact, the dot-coms and some of the other email scams are sort of an equivalent.
Well, I do think that any time you see a possibility for a fast fortune, people bring up the California Gold Rush. And certainly during the, you know, the dot-com boom in the 90s, you know, it didn't hurt that a lot of this was coming out of California as well. But when one sees those kinds of references, I think what concerns me about that is that it's a kind of narrowing of the meaning of the Gold Rush, that it's simply about making a quick buck, a fast fortune, and it ignores the much more complex human drama of the California Gold Rush, the kind of cosmopolitan world that really started with the California Gold Rush and has continued in various ways in California and other parts of the West. And the lessons, I think, that come from these processes of exclusion and discrimination that we still need to be thinking about in our own time.
UW historian Susan Lee Johnson has been with us for this hour. She's the author of Roaring Camp, The Social World of the California Gold Rush. And Quite a whirl it was, too. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. In the meantime, a song from the Gold Rush, Days of 49 with Fred Holstein.
Saucy crew, a few hard cases I will admit, though they were brave and true. Whate'er the pinch, they ne'er would flinch, they ne'er would sweat or whine. Like good old bricks, they took the kicks in the days of 49. Jess, a mean old cuss who never would relent. He was never known to miss a drink or ever spend a cent. But old lame Jess, just like the rest, to death he did resign. And in his bloom went up the flume in the days of 49. Poker Bill, one of the boys who was always in for a game. And whether he lost or whether he won, to him it was all the same. He'd ante up, he'd draw his cards, he'd go you a hat full blind. In the game with death, Bill lost his breath in the days of 49. Ragshack Bob from Buffalo, I never will forget. He'd roar all day and roar all night, I guess he's roaring yet. One night he fell in a prospect hole, a roaring bad design. And in that hole roared out his soul in the days of 49. There was New York Jake, the butcher's boy, who was always getting tight. Every time Jake got drunk, he was looking for a fight. One night he ran up against a knife in the hands of old Bob Syme. And over Jake, they held a wake in the days of 49. In the days of 49, in the days of old, in the days of gold, how often I repine for the days of old when we dug up gold in the days of 49.